George Ashley's issues joined with the government in 5 days with individual issues. President, 5 minutes for the while. Mr. Wilder, for the president, in 10 minutes for the election. I'd like to start with the issue of the expert testimony in my opinion in this case. At many points throughout the trial, Agent Lane and testimony violated federal rules of evidence 704B. And I'd like to start by referring to Morales, which will prohibit payment interest on rule 704B.
Ms. Lindell, can you spell out for me the respects in which it does? Because I just don't see it. What he did was to testify, for example, that this was a distribution. I mean, let's suppose somebody says this is a distribution size, a quantity size distribution. You know what I mean. All right. Let's just suppose that. Is that testifying on the ultimate issue?
That's not exactly what that's.
Okay.
He may have done that at certain points, but that's not all.
Okay, so where does he even come close to saying these people intended to distribute it? When he is saying, look, this was an offer, it was to sell cocaine for X dollars, and we picked up the purchase later, or we picked up the cash.
Well, first of all, Robert, I'd like to, you never have to use the metric word intent to violate rule 704B, and that's clear from Hannah. There are a lot of rules that are synonymous. Here. There are points in which he said, this is an offer for Mr. Davis to sell cocaine.
What's wrong with that?
That is more problematic because the word offer is contained in an implicit. If the jury believes that testimony, then they have no choice but to believe.
What's he supposed to do? What's he supposed to do?
He can testify that, okay, that this series of numbers, 13500, is correlates to the average price of low number. Can say that this seven-digit series belongs to a particular subscriber. He can say, based on other, as some of the defense perhaps, that this two-digit series or three-digit series, he's managed to correlate a particular identity. That's what he can do. But what he can't do is he can't make sweeping conclusions about the entire meaning of his narrative messages. And there's, in addition to these, I don't want to talk about the publication entirely, but the other fundamental problem is it's a 702 problem because it usurps the jury's function in making a decision about the defendant's intent and about what happened. There's cases, and most of them can't recognize this problem. They can't recognize this problem under 702 and 704. There are other cases from other circuits where they courts have expressed concerns that agent testimony, particularly from case agents where a case agent is used both as a fact witness and as an expert, runs the risk of, it gives the prosecutor two bites of the apple. The prosecutor gets to make a closing argument, presenting their argument as expert evidence. And that is a problem because it does usurp the jury's function.
Weren't these statements just very few and far between if you consider all of Delaney's testimony? And let's assume we even agreed with you. Why don't they just constitute harmless error in light of all the other evidence?
Well, because Agent Delaney's testimony completely permeated the trial. He testified that the prosecution's case was 22 days to present. He testified on 11. His testimony was over 1,500 pages of transcript. Entire report schedule, including pre-trial proceedings, which was 6,179 pages. So, that would be pre-trial. So, we assume that maybe 300 or 400 pages is for him, 200 is pre-trial. We have a trial transcript of approximately 6,000 pages. That's over 25% of the whole transcript, not just for the prosecution's case. So,
but how much of that was really?
A lot of it. And because the improper interpretations occurred throughout, it's impossible. I mean, I have 80 pages of notes from Lane's testimony, just a typed notes of Lane's testimony. It's not, I mean, I gave an example that I can pull out from my group, but when you go through it, it's not possible to say, well, this part is okay, and this part is not.
Well,
except at the very beginning where he clearly says, well, you know, this is a kilogram price, and that's what.
Well, your challenge is to the admissibility of the whole thing, isn't it?
Well, there's two challenges. Yes, we did make a general sentencing challenge, and we decided to argue that it shouldn't have come, the parts of it shouldn't have come in at all. We've never contended that you couldn't properly testify as to the kilograms height and certain numbers.
So he could testify that they're working in a code. He can testify as an expert as to what the code is.
Well,
I mean, I'm trying to figure out just what is so bad about this.
That goes back to the 702 Foundation issue, which is a separate forum to talk about. There is a problem with that, because I don't think he was sufficiently qualified to testify as to the code. He didn't have any background in pager codes by his own admission. He never dealt with pager codes before. He was a drug agent. He worked on wiretap cases.
But isn't that what the discretionary call is of the district court?
To some extent, but there is, you know, there's abuse of discretion, and the standard of 702 is significantly higher than we're talking about abuse of discretion under 402, because there's things not to be considered. And among them are all those factors that are set out in Talbert, Kumo, including. Is there a known error rate? What percentage can be interpreted?
This isn't exactly the Enigma code. I mean, it's a.
Yes, you're right. And that's obviously why. That's one of the reasons why. And that brings us again back to the helpfulness issue.
Well, you know, tell me why it's not helpful, given the fact that there were 5,000 intercepted pager transmissions and 4,424 outgoing calls, 2,878 voice intercepts, 5,188 calls to Davis's pager. Is the jury supposed to sit down there and figure it all out, even though maybe if they took a year they could?
Your Honor, there is a jury. It's not the jury has to figure every single one of these codes and figure it out. The prosecution did prepare, they had several witnesses, they had charts,
why isn't this helpful?
It's helpful. The problem is it's not helpful in a way that's legally permissible. It's helpful. It's helpful for a psychiatrist to testify. I know the defendant intended to take this crime. It's helpful. Many things are helpful. Things are not allowed.
Well, what is the jury? We were discussing the testimony about explaining what the code was.
Right.
Now, you're saying that goes to some ultimate question that has to be decided by the jury and cannot be the subject of expert testimony as to how the code worked?
Well, yeah, not...
No.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's not that much of what he's being testified to was fine, but it is the sweeping conclusions about the complete meaning of the messages that usurp the jury's assumption. It's the jury's job to decide if this message...
there are certain questions that were asked that were improper because they went to matters that were exclusively within the province of the jury. Is that your argument? Okay. Now, were there objections to those questions?
There were objections at the beginning to that, and the citation is ER 591. It was raised at the beginning, and then the judge made this rather cryptic ruling about the opening the door issue, and essentially ruled at one point that everything could come in.
Yeah, I just didn't see any record here of specific questions that were wrong, that should have been excluded, that the district court erred in not excluding.
What happened was, the way the testimony came in, is the prosecutor had these logs, logs of the numbers, and she'd say, what does this mean, and what does this mean, and what does this mean? And so this agent would say, this means this, and based on the court's prior ruling, the court had essentially said that's okay.
So it came in. Now, there were certain of those that you think that were improper, or that the answers were improper or incorrect?
Improper. Whether they're correct or not, I'm not arguing the delays in interpretation. Well, I guess certainly some of the interpretations were probably wrong. But it's
Well, but that's classically the subject of the stuff of cross-examination, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Not question,
okay. Want to go to your next point?
Yeah. Okay. I did want to discuss the Bhutan, the addition of the acid Bhutan statement.
Why is it even error? Because the only time it came close to implicating Davis was by use of 84. And according to your brief, there were between six and a dozen instances where, I mean, other people were identified as having used 84. So I don't even see why there's error, let alone why it's prejudicial.
Well, on the prejudice issue, let me just first address that there was a problem with the statement. It was use of personal pronouns that arguably there's some personal pronouns that were missed. One was the word they, which clearly says the Medina statement, it was a lot of that Medina was involved in boyfriend process. And but the use of the word they clearly implies that there's more than one.
It's true.
Even that.
But it doesn't imply who.
In Gray, you know, Gray talks about reference to the existence of the non-confessing defendant. That's what's not permitted. You can't have ellipses or blanks or personal pronouns that indicate that the non-confessing defendant, Mr. Davis, existed. And Gray's statement was ambiguous, but the problem is it did point the finger at Davis. There was also...
But let me just ask about that. Wasn't there overwhelming evidence linking Davis to Medina and Rosas and the 47-kilogram seizure?
There was a lot of evidence.
And wouldn't that then take care of this particular issue?
Well, I suppose the harmless error isn't valid. It's not. I don't see harmless error as just whether there's evidence on this particular issue. The evidence is whether all of this came in.
Well, we were talking about the use of 84, and I'm just saying there is overwhelming evidence. You may have many other examples, but I kept going through the record and going through the record and going through the record, and I, quite honestly speaking for myself, was just left with the impression that there were several questions that might have been improper, but there was overwhelming evidence to remove prejudice.
Yeah.
Well,
both. Well, then I should talk about harmless error, perhaps, in an overall sense. I did want to spend a little bit of time on this point as well. I'll talk about harmless error instead. I have already talked about it in the context of the lady, but I do want to talk about it, and I'll talk about it in the context of prosecutorial misconduct, the DNA statement, and the indication of this amendment. One of the key things in the prosecution's case, Davis is a violent, threatening, and dangerous man. The prosecutor talk about the violent acts to a great extent in our own statements. Of course, as I pointed out earlier, some of those acts were later excluded by the district court. The other fact goes to harmless, and again, this goes to the general harmless error, but errors are not harmless in this case. The Medina's indication of the fifth on the stand, it bolstered the prosecution's case in an unanswerable way because it constituted extra record proof that here is somebody who was actually being intimidated by Mr. Davis, surely actually just by his mere presence, perhaps by some unknown Confederate suspect. And these errors, and I made a cumulative error argument, these errors considered together cannot be harmed.
But certainly not alone, because the government never referred to that again.
In terms of the open...
They never referred to the meaning of her invoking the fifth.
No, they didn't, but that's not required. What's required is that the act of... these are old cases. It hasn't been addressed recently. But my reading is... There's two problems. One is whether the prosecutor thought there was a substantial chance that the witness would serve the fifth. And there's clearly a factual dispute about that that was not an adequate hearing on that subject. And the second, whether the act of the voting of the fifth in fact bolstered the prosecution's case in an unanswerable way. Just, huh? Sorry for shaking your head.
I just don't see what difference, if you're right on every one of these things, I'm just not sure what difference it's going to make in the end. Because I don't see the relationship of any of these things to any critical disputed matter in the case. That's what I'm...
It is, Your Honor, because, for example, it's critical to many of the things. For example, when we look at Delaney's testimony, one of the key things that the jury's asked to decide was how much was whether my client was going to continue to criminal enterprise. How and whether he supervised. So they had to find that he supervised, he was a private participant, and they had to find that he distributed, they did find that he distributed over 100 kilograms. Well, Delaney's testimony is critical, particularly as a quantity finding, which is recognized in the mandatory life sentence. Because without that, if he made all these two things, the conclusion is going to be understood by one. But that it is good.
Yeah, Delaney, yeah, I was referring to the other. Yeah, the other one.
The testament, the effect of evidence that the defendant is dangerous and violent really can't be overstated. It's overwhelmingly prejudicial. There's just a difficult, the result may well be different if this evidence is excluded. We're not talking about exclusion evidence, excuse me, we're talking about Martinez's information as the combined with the prosecutor's statements.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning. Can I please report me on behalf of Mr. McCoy? I will be addressing two issues. I will be asked to reserve 2 minutes of my time. First, I would like to pick up briefly on the lengthy expert witness argument. To make a basic point, which I'm sure the court recognizes, that the prejudice, the calculus of prejudice as to Mr. McCoy is different as to each issue raised, each joint issue and separate issue. And Judge Weimer initially, I think, Judge Schroeder, several points asked, what is the specific testimony that we are complaining about? Well, it's very clear with respect to Mr. McCoy. There really are only two instances of direct testimony by Agent Delaney after Mr. McCoy. One dealing with the 8-4-0-6-7 Kansas City transaction, and the other fairly extensive segment on February 12th, in which Agent Delaney goes through a series of phone calls from the inception of the wiretap in December through March. And it's a call in December, a couple of calls in January, a couple of calls in February, a couple of calls in March. And as to each of these, there is a pager. There's some pager evidence, and then there's an associated telephone.
So what's wrong with that?
I'm about to get to that. What is wrong with that is that to each of those transactions, Agent Delaney states that a transaction actually occurred. This was, in fact, a consummated cooperative agreement.
What's wrong with that?
There's no cooperation. There is
I understand.
No cooperation.
What's wrong with the testimony? I just don't, I guess I just have a fundamental problem here. I must have tried 300 or 400 of these cases with an agent sitting there and describing in detail what happened. I just don't understand the problem. It's not saying that McCoy intended to distribute cocaine. It's saying on this date, here is something which occurred.
But what he said occurred was that McCoy, in fact, did distribute cocaine.
He said there was an offer. McCoy called Davis or McCoy called somebody else, was told to show up at a particular place, make a delivery, whatever.
There's no surveillance. One looks at the telephone conversation.
Yeah.
The associated conversation. If Agent Delaney's own declaration in opposition to the suppression motion, he characterized those as fairly benign. They have to do with Davis' gambling, one of them has to do with the Super Bowl, they have to do with McCoy's female problems. There is not a stitch of corroboration as to any of these transactions. So the only evidence before the jury demonstrating that in fact the transactions occurred is Agent Delaney's testimony. That's a clear...
Yeah, so the only way they could catch the guy was by deciphering telephone calls. So what?
They didn't surveil him.
But so what?
The telephone call...
Is there any case authority that says they have to surveil somebody?
There is case authority in the Morales Club that says the agent cannot take the place of the jury, cannot
Okay.
Through his conclusions for the jury. The other place is that, and also for much additional time, is the anti-dollars of prejudice. Agent Delaney's testimony was 89% of the evidence against Mr. McCoy. Therefore, if in fact, our argument is correct, and that there was a low case submission of that evidence, and there wasn't any participation in the jury's role, it cannot be said.
Okay. Why don't you go to your other point?
My other point, the court is the court and infected all the other issues. And I recognize some of the uphill argument by virtue of the standard review. Nevertheless, I would submit that this is a case in which manifest prejudice is manifest. And I would submit that that's for three reasons. I'm going to go into detail, but in summary, they are that first, the quantity and quality of the evidence against Mr. Davis was so disparate from that against Mr. McCoy that they would necessarily have this
Go ahead.
The second point is that the court's criteria for disability became so broad that essentially it was guilt by association. And the third is, in light of the first two problems, the instructions were inadequate. They were not the strong cautionary instructions that even the government stated were necessary. They were inconsistently given, and they were essentially generic instructions except Mr. Taylor.
What's the closest Ninth Circuit case that would support granting Mr. McCoy a new trial?
Well, I don't think that any of the cases that the government has cited, and I agree that the government has not favored the defendant, but none of the cases that the government has cited show that Mr. McCoy should not be granted a new trial in this case.
Well, that's true, but let me ask you a more specific question, because there are some cases where there has been an order of a new trial because two defendants were tried together. But most of those cases that I am familiar with involve Bruton error, that is the admission of a confession of a co-defendant that implicates the defendant. Now, this case does not involve Bruton error. I'm just wondering if you have any authority that held that because of the prejudice that one guy is a bad guy, worse guy than my client, or my client is a little guy, and this is a big guy, which is frequently tried together for all kinds of reasons. But in that kind of situation, even without Bruton error, we ordered a reversal. And there aren't any there that I can see.
There was no case that dealt with specific circumstances because it would be highly unusual for a judge to allow this case to proceed, given, again, the disparity in the quantity of evidence and the extraordinary disparity in quality of evidence. All of this evidence and violence came in largely without specific limiting instructions, except for Ron Taylor. The gentleman's Lynch came in, Mr. Johnson came in, and an assortment of other evidence scattered throughout the trial.
The judge did, of course, give standard cautionary instructions to take evidence as to each defendant and so forth. Were any cautionary instructions requested that he didn't give?
There was, in fact, as soon as the judge finished, there was a cautionary instruction requested, and the court indicated that he could give that instruction and then decided to give instruction at the end of the evidence.
Well, was there any request that he please kindly do it in the middle?
Well, in advance of the testimony, there was.
And he refused to do it or forgot to?
He said he could do it and didn't do it.
Well, I mean, I know. Judges are human.
Yes, I know.
Okay, so he forgets or whatever. Did anybody stand up and say, you know, time out?
At that point,
no. Okay.
But I would also mention there's several instances in the record in which trial counsel has said to the judge, let's develop a methodology for my objection, you know. That I object to all of this extraneous evidence coming in, as extraneous as Mr. McCoy. Let's develop a methodology so I'm not jumping up every minute. And that has been done, though it is stated several times in the record. I also wanted to get to, I've read this language several times, it's not my want to quote from judgments and rules, the court has the record. Nevertheless, I have read this language several times, and it is a criteria by which Judge Jensen admitted all of the evidence against David and he says as follows. I'm not, as it says, ER-284. I'm not really impressed with the notion that if you're able to show data in order in conspiracy to do the truth cocaine, that is evidence, and there is no evidence. It's evidence that Mr. Davis is drug trafficking to circumstantial proof of the nature of his relationship with the court because he's a drug trafficker. In essence, what the court has said is that any evidence regarding Mr. Davis' drug trafficking is probative of Mr. McCoy's guilt. That is the essence of guilt by association. There's no clearer. The line between circumstantial evidence, between the inference from the fact that Mr. Davis is a drug dealer to the fact that Mr. McCoy is a drug dealer, that is evidence of guilt. That's the nature of the problem. And nowhere does the court draw the line between valid circumstantial evidence and prejudicial spillover. And again, that goes back to the evidence of the instruction, but we also mentioned that one of the problems with the generic...
Well, where in the record do we find the instruction that would have reminded the jury to distinguish between those things that you're discussing?
There is a difference. Okay. And I did want to mention that this is kind of... if you take the instruction as a whole, you have on one hand what is the general, you know, separate consideration, separate instruction. On the other hand, you have a pendant instruction, which is within the model instruction, and essentially undercuts that in terms of separate consideration. It says, for any defendant, you
right.
can consider...
Right. We all have some trouble from time to time with Pinkerton, but it is the law.
It's a key in terms of it's the only instruction that the government is pointing to as curative is the generic general consideration.
Thank you.
I have with that is that the way the government put on the witnesses, if I were a juror, it would be very hard for me to compartmentalize evidence against Davis, evidence against McCoy. It just kept coming up, even though there are 88 pages, it depends on where it comes up and how often it comes up and how strong that evidence is. There were some pretty violent acts described.
Well, it ended up, Your Honor, being Mr. Taylor, who's a cooperating witness, testifying about some threats or discussions. There was Mr. Johnson, who had been the object of one of the threats, and that was several pages that came in. There was Ms. Lynch, who apparently had been working with the enforcer, Mr. Max, who had nothing to do with McCoy. Her, I copied all of her testimony. There was an officer who had mastered that apparently said to him, I'm an enforcer. There were some telephone conversations that related to violence, but none of it, the key to the government's case against Mr. McCoy and against Mr. Davis, the critical evidence in the government's case was the telephone conversation. The pager codes were important, but much of Agent Delaney's testimony, just to remember, didn't relate to pager codes. It was playing the tape. And these, the government's appendix, this is nowhere near all of them.
Well, I'm not referring to Delaney's testimony. I'm referring to the evidence of violent acts by Davis and the impression. I mean, I have to honestly say it was very shocking kinds of evidence. And even though the one page out of 100, if that one page is pretty shocking.
If you read the Fedora's report came in, it comes in as just talking about it. I mean, the evidence that was most. That would have been most shocking was excluded by the district court under Rule 403. The district court.
You mean there was more?
There was certainly more. There was, the district court, there was additional evidence that the district court excluded. What ended up coming in was a very small portion of the testimony. And the district court gave careful instructions. I also want to point out that, as counsel said, the principal evidence against Mr. McCoy was in Delaney's testimony. And there was a demarcation of the different parts of Delaney's testimony. The prosecutor carefully, before they turned to the interstate conspiracy, which is the conspiracy that McCoy was charged with, Davis was charged with the different conspiracies. She said, now you're Agent Delaney, we're turning to a new set of tapes, and these relate to interstate communications. Is that correct? And so they marked out the parts of the file, and the case relating to Mr. McCoy basically came in during that segment of the trial. So it was compartmentalized. And it's also important to note that there was overwhelming evidence, certainly against Mr. Davis, that I don't even think I can support that
argument. Well, I'm just querying the failure to sever McCoy, and because of the shocking evidence, in my opinion, against Davis, how the jury could separate it.
I guess you read the testimony and not accept counsel seems to be, at points in the brief, maybe putting in some of the evidence that didn't come in, and that would have been more shocking. If the court goes through and reads the pages, it doesn't seem the kind of thing that, obviously, this court has said that there's a very heavy burden on a defendant to show these kind of careful instructions in addition to the generic instructions, the instruction, this is exactly what I was telling you about, you don't consider this. The defendants bear a very heavy burden to overcome the presumption of those who the jury follows its instructions. I also want to point out that the evidence with respect to Mr. McCoy was also on the charge he was ultimately convicted on. There was certainly overwhelming evidence in the form of his own telephone conversations with Davis of his involvement in the Kansas City transaction, which is the basis of all the substance that passed against him and the basis of the sentence, 3 kilos. That evidence was simply overwhelming. And there's no way in which hearing, especially hearing the careful instructions not to pay attention to it with respect to McCoy, hearing this much evidence of violent acts or threats of intimidation by Mr. Davis could have influenced the jury to convict him on those charges because the evidence of his involvement in the subsequent transaction through his own words to talk about the conversation was also overwhelming. I can go through.
There's a law that you have to sever cases. Do we have law that if some of the evidence is going to be very strong, is going to involve violence that against one that the case has to be severed?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. There's a case cited in our brief where. One of these, none of these cases is exactly the same,
right.
But they're involved evidence of violent acts. I think it's an older case, but no, the law is that there's a very, very strong abuse of discretion standard. And the question before this court is whether a joint trial in this case, given the instructions, was so manifestly prejudicial as to require the court to exercise its discretion because the defendant was the
denied a fair trial. And the Escalante case, where the co-defendant had participated apparently in a murder, and this court said, and had organized crime connection, things would be very prejudicial, and then, shocking. And this court said, our court assumes the jury listened to and followed the trial judge's instructions.
Let me ask, of the 6,000 pages of testimony, what proportion of the testimony was against Davis?
Well, Your Honor, the just against Davis.
Yes.
That's a hard question to answer. I'd say well over half, probably three quarters. But it's also important to remember that Mr. McCoy was charged with conspiracy. And I think the district court's remark, the counsel relying on evidence that Davis, that there was the existence of a drug trafficking conspiracy, clearly that's an element that the government is required to prove. So, although I don't think we can say that evidence relating to the interstate drug conspiracy, even if it didn't refer to it quite specifically, I don't think we can say that it didn't. It clearly related to an element that the government is required to prove beyond reasonable doubt, which is the existence of that conspiracy. That being said, and also I want to go a little further back, the evidence of that the tied McCoy to the conspiracy in large part was showing that he used the same system of coded communication, the same code numbers, the same way of talking about using women's references, your little broad, and all that to refer to men that was used by other members, Mr. Taylor, the cooperating witness, who were also in this interstate conspiracy. And that clearly, in our view, was evidence the jury could rely on to tie McCoy into the conspiracies. So even though a lot of the evidence didn't relate to McCoy directly, but it was relevant evidence that the jury could rely on to find one of the elements of the conspiracy offense. I don't know whether the court wants me to start going through the issues, or if you have areas that are bothering you, I would really like to address them. I did want to say one thing about the 704B. I think if the governing precedents are for Manning and Plump, and if the court looks at the statements in those cases that were held to be perfectly permissible under 704B, it's clear that testimony about coded messages that show willingness to participate in a drug offense is not forbidden testimony about intent. I also urge the court to not just look at the number of pages, look at the overwhelming testimony, but to look at the overwhelming evidence against the defendant that was not involving the case of
COVID. Okay, I think we have your
point.
Thank you.
The government has argued that the phone conversation and the funeral application pose were overwhelming evidence of guilt. And that most of the conversations in the U.S., there were some that were clearly incriminatory. Those went to the one I'm thinking of is the one that went to 47 after the attempted buyback, the aborted attempted buyback of 47 kilograms. But beyond that, most of them were completely ambiguous. And in that sense, we can't. If the government would say that the pager code evidence was not the bulk of the case, it was the bulk of the case against the defendants. The second point I wanted to address was Plump. Plump does not control this case. First of all, Plump involves a very brief interpretation of some COVID words. How funny is Machina? Machina, like we need to reference. This case involves a number of codes, which is, there are no cases involving number codes. Second of all, Delaney used language that is synonymous with intent, used words like offered, confirmed.
These words contain a definition and I'm content with them. That distinguishes this case from Plunk. Finally, Plunk is not overruled, but Plunk did not fully address the applicability of, obviously, Plunk did not address applicable to Kumho, did not understand. Plunk was pre-Kumho, so there's that problem as well. The case that is more pertinent to the facts of this case is Hannah, in this circuit.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Landau.
Lastly,
quickly,
I would like to go back to the issue of prejudice and in the context of severance, and in the context of all our issues. And then you have to bear in mind that the defense in this case was multiple conspiracies, while there may, in fact, be substantial evidence that Mr. McCoy was a customer, Mr. Davis, I don't think the government, I don't think the defense argued otherwise. The issue was he a member of the Camp Reef interstate conspiracy simply by virtue of the transaction of his nature? The Chinese role is actually not represented by the money. One thing for him to look at is when he looks at Ron Taylor and Robert Johnson's testimony, it is fairly apparent that the Camp Reef conspiracy, as previously constituted, ended in March of 1998. Because between the fall of 1997 and March of 1998, all of the main co-conspirators in Indiana, in Missouri, and in Kentucky are arrested. And many of them are shot, some of them are killed. So effectively, that conspiracy has ended. But the failure to set up the trial is an opportunity to defend the defendant of the conspiracy because of this spillover of evidence from these people.
Thank you, counsel. The matters just argued are submitted for decision. That concludes the court's calendar for this morning. And the court stands adjourned.
All right. This court stands adjourned.